Привіт всім! Це подкаст «Коли все має значення». Мене звати Ангеліна Карякіна.
А я Наталя Гуменюк.
Ну і говоримо ми сьогодні з людиною, з якою ми вже кілька років, 2 роки працюємо в одній команді «The Reckoning Project». Людина ця цікава не лише тим, що вона робить в проєкті, це безцінна абсолютно робота, а і своїм походженням, і взагалі розумінням того, що відбувається у світі міжнародного права і воєнних злочинів. Це британський адвокат, юрист сирійського походження Ібрагім Олабі. Наталко, ми нещодавно від проєкту, від організації разом з Ібрагімом готували і подали в суд в Аргентині кримінальний позов щодо тортур, перший в історії український позов в Аргентині. Чи це було першим предметом вашої розмови, чи ви взагалі говорили про нашу роботу трошки ширше, тому що працюємо ми давно, але з Ібрагімом ми ще інтерв'ю не записували?
Саме так, ми з цього почали. Я мала змогу на один день проїхати через Лондон, де ми зустрілися з Ібрагімом. Він є юридичним директором The Reckoning Project, власне, людиною, яка визначила юридичну стратегію. І це була Ібрагіма ідея подати цей позов в Аргентині. Працювала велика команда юристів, ну і наша команда на місці, яка займалася свідком, питаннями, які стосувалися правоохоронних органів, організацією всього, фільмом документальним, але саме юридичну частину готувала команда на чолі з Ібрагімом. Я попросила розповісти, як це було і чому, як вони обирали країну, чому саме ця країна, не тільки юридично, але чому таку стратегію обрав він. Почують наші слухачі в подкасті, чому дозволяється Конституція Аргентини, навіщо нам робити це за межами Європи, які є шанси, чому злочин тортур. Ми про все це говорили. Але мені було дуже цікаво почути ще одну дуже важливу річ. Ібрагім згадав таке, що вкоїться проти жертв злочинів ще один злочин. Злочин заперечення. І він, зокрема, як сирієць, дуже добре це розуміє, що спочатку людей вбивають, спочатку, я не знаю, бомблять міста, викрадають, але російська пропаганда, так само, як і в випадку з Сирією, намагається сказати, цього всього не було, це все вигадка. І це також велика травма і біль для всіх, хто потерпає, хто з цим працює. І тому, особливо в умовах цієї пропаганди, йому було теж дуже важливо сказати, що на тій частині світу, де намагаються підставити під сумнів сам факт того, що робить Росія, чи якось розмити це все, сказати, що все непросто, дуже важливо також юридично довести, чому, що це відбувається, що мають бути справи. Тому перша частина нашої розмови саме про відкриття справи в Аргентині, юридичну стратегію, навіщо це потрібно і що може відбутися.
Крім його експертизи, яка його особиста мотивація взагалі займатися цим?
Це друга частина, ціла частина нашої розмови, бо Ібрагім підтверджує не один раз. Він походить з арабської родини, з купою різних корінь, але з доволі заможної, успішної родини і мав можливість навчатися в британському університеті в Оксфорді. Але почалася війна громадянська в Сирії. Я спокійно використовую цей термін «громадянська війна», бо режим там намагається сказати, що це все були терористи, а не люди поставали проти режиму. І він ще молодим студентом з комерційного права перейшов на оце право гуманітарне і став очільником власної організації, яка займається юридичним захистом. Його основна тема – це справи, які стосуються використання хімічної зброї Росією проти сирійців. Ну, багато із злочинів, які стосуються арабських країн, там, і Лівії, і Ємену. І його запрошували долучатися до багатьох інших, окрім Сирії. Але він сказав, що Україна – це єдина країна, на яку, скажімо так, він відволікся, тому що вважає, що це продовження тієї самої боротьби, що це ті самі злочинці і частина нашої розмови, зокрема, і про його роботу в Сирії. Він, окрім того, що працює з нами торік, організовував візит солідарності ключових представників громадянського суспільства Сирії до України. Ріна теж допомагала їм зустрітися лікарям сирійським, з Алеппо, з лікарями з Маріупольського пологового. Тому там є інша ще вимір.
Не пологового, з Маріупольської обласної лікарні, яка приймала жінок з пологового.
Добре, що поправила. Тому там є ще інша історія про наші сирійсько-українські відносини, цю спільну емпатію. Але мені дуже зрезонувала його думка, яка буде на кінці розмови про мотивацію. Бо він, як юрист, дуже багато пояснює, чому треба думати про процеси проти цих злочинців, не думаючи винятково про результат, як людину за ґратами. Чому сам процес є вкрай важливим для потерпілих, для жертв, для всіх. І якщо ми всі будемо думати винятково тим, наскільки серйозне буде покарання у злочинців, то, в принципі, можна інколи взагалі не братися за ці справи. Він наводить дуже багато прикладів, чому сам процес по факту є вкрай важливим для всіх і чому так працює це міжнародне право. Але ще одна річ, яка мені теж зрезонувала і була відповіддю для мене, для багатьох речей, хоча ніби ми спілкуємося там щодня. Він сказав, що він має привілей цим займатися. Він ніколи не очікує від всіх людей займатися якимись болючими справами, Сирією, Україною, перейматися, бути включеними, там віддавати на це все свій час, здоров'я. Але він вважає, що він привілейована людина, яка має спроможність. Не всі жертви мають змогу постояти за себе, писати заяви, розповідати про те, що з ними сталося. Бо це все дуже складно. А як людина, яка має привілей знати право, вивчитися в Лондоні, мати час і моральні сили, він тепер вважається своїм обов'язком. Мені дійсно дуже ця думка якось закріпилася в моєму розумінні. Чи дійсно ми теж трошечки, але маємо привілей. Він, можливо, менше, бо ми всі теж потерпаємо, але для нас займатися це всім, можливість є в чомусь для нас привілеєм.
Ти знаєш, в чомусь, якщо можна порівнювати, напевно, і можна назвати привілеєм нашим з точки зору права, порівнюючи нас з сирійцями, тому що ми з Ібрагімом говорили, і він казав нам, слухайте, у вас є можливість подати у власний суд, попросити власні правоохоронні органи займатися цим, і вони цим займаються. У нас, у сирійців, такої можливості немає, бо це нас, наш уряд разом з росіянами бомбили, травили хімічною зброєю, катували, вбивали і так далі. У нас такої можливості немає, так? Це нам постійно треба думати, вигадувати, як взагалі добиватися цієї справедливості. Плюс дізнатися, хто нас бомбив, коли, чиї це були літаки. Ну, зараз ми розуміємо, що це дуже важко приховати, але, в принципі, їм на їхньому шляху до справедливості, безумовно, порівнювати треба дуже обережно, але їм в рази складніше, ніж нам. І в цьому сенсі це якась відповідь тим скептикам, які постійно кажуть, ну і що, ну от ви подали, і що Путіна посадять, і що от там Шойгу посадять. Ну, не це кінцева задача, якраз такі люди, як Ібрагім, дуже круто вміють пояснювати, в чому взагалі сенс, прагматичний сенс самого факту подачі судового позову, то і процесу, а і загалом процесу в ширшому розумінні цього слова. Тож давайте слухати розмову Наталки з Ібрагімом Олабі.
First of all, so finally glad to talk to you, because we worked together, but we really didn't do any formal interview with you. I think the number one question, and we don't want to make credit for this, because now we have a lot of opportunities to explain why we go for the criminal complaint in Argentina. And I always said that was the idea of the legal team. So it was your idea, Ibrahim. Why? You know, I'm not really asking just about why, what we explain to everybody. But how did you work on that?
Sure, no, thanks. Thanks, Natalia. And, you know, obviously this was a big team effort. The reason why we wanted to focus on Argentina was a number of reasons. So first of all, it was important for us with more propaganda showing that, you know, what's happening in Ukraine is just a Western conspiracy, that these crimes are not real, to put them before a competent judiciary that's not Western. And a judiciary that dealt with torture, a judiciary that dealt with these kind of experiences in that sense. So this is where the idea for Argentina came from. The Argentine people, through their parliament, through their judiciary, made it clear that Argentina will not be a safe haven for international crimes or international criminals. and that they have accepted to look into cases that happened wherever they are and wherever they took place. So this is where it started. It started from this idea that the pain that victims are going through is doubled. One, you have the actual physical pain, but then you also have this idea of denial that just because the West is supporting, that means that what you suffered is not real and it's propaganda and it's fake and it's all a Western conspiracy. That's the core of it. The narrative, preserving the evidence and the narrative and allowing a country that's from the global South to look at it independently. And that's where the idea started from.
But are there at all a lot of countries in the world, and what is the difference? Where we have the universal jurisdiction, but what makes it different?
Sure. So when, before we kind of selected Argentina, we did a kind of mapping exercise as to where which countries exist that allow their judiciary to look into this. And there aren't that many. There aren't that many that have this idea of pure universal jurisdiction, which means regardless of where the perpetrator is, regardless where the crime took place, regardless where the victim is, we can look into it. So there are one or two countries in Africa, one or two countries in Latin America. But the main thing is that Argentina has set a precedent in the past in being one of the leaders for justice. And that's also helped our decision in that sense. And also because they unfortunately have a history of torture that also made them specialized in this matter and torture by electrocution as well. You know, so it's very relevant to this case.
I've been answering quite a few questions from journalists myself, but it's my opportunity to pass it to you. So quite a common question is, you know, so what do you want? You know, and this kind of rather banal question, but would there be the perpetrator on the court bench?
I think that the premise of that question is understandable where it's coming from. But the starting point, in my opinion, conflates what we expect from domestic local justice with from what we expect from international strategic litigation. So as I mentioned initially, the first key success indicator is showing that the victim is resisting. It's showing that we're not giving up. That's, in my opinion, the first success. To show to perpetrators that people are willing to travel, God knows how long you traveled with the survivor, to go to Argentina halfway, thousands of miles away, I think it's almost tens of thousands of miles away, and make the case. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to be able, through the coverage of what happened and the criminal complaint, to shed light on torture. Remember the article said the size of the cell, the type of torture, all of that. To again bring back the narrative. That is a form of accountability. Shedding light on the narrative is a form of accountability. Victims not being afraid and going all over there is a form of accountability. Hopefully when the Argentine judiciary accepts to look into it, that is a form of accountability that you got a country involved. So the process is the outcome in that sense. Because if you think of it, even in a domestic sense, if, God forbid, you know, a loved one was passing down the street and a drunk driver hit them and killed them, what is justice? Your loved one is not coming back. But the process, the day in court, the fact that someone stood up for you is all part of that. So the perpetrators being arrested, in my opinion, is a small part of success. But the process itself makes a difference. How many Serbs leaders and from the former Yugoslavian court died before the sentence came out? But the fact that they were dragged into court, the fact that victims were in the court, the fact that victims went and give their evidence, is all part of it. Because the problem is, Natalia, if we only focus on perpetrator-based justice and the likelihood of getting arrested, then we'll never start a process. And I'll finish on this on this point. Perpetrators don't get arrested in Mission Impossible commando-style way. The way they get arrested is there is arrest warrants, the political pressure becomes higher, then they get handed over by their former allies, usually, you know, or that they travel somewhere and they get arrested. And so I know the likelihood of perpetrators getting arrested is zero if we don't do anything. In that sense, so if we do something, it increases the chances. But again, that's only one metric.
You earlier mentioned something about justice as a process. Can you explain? And You being a lawyer, mentioned something about the coverage. I'm coming from a different side. The journalist, for us, coverage is a usual thing, and we think that should be something else. Why that matters for you?
Because justice to be done needs to be seen to be done. That's why we have public hearings. If you now go from our offices here in London and you cross the street to the Royal Courts of Justice, you can sit in almost any trial in that sense at the public hearing. And so it's important for the reasons of the narrative. It's important to maintain the public interest. It's important in terms of signaling that we shed light on whatever we can shed light on in a responsible way. Not in a way that over-exaggerates, in a way that manages expectations, of course. But that is key for any justice processes in order to be able to set a historical mark, to say, today, one victim resisted. Showing the fact that a victim did that and that organizations did that might encourage others, might send a message to perpetrators that we're not giving up, sends a message to the Argentine people about what's happening in Ukraine. So this balance between coverage and a legal process is absolutely key in the wars that we are fighting today, the wars for justice, because they are fought, as we often say, in the courts of law, but also in the courts of public opinion and how they both interact.
I'd like you to tell us a bit more about how your team worked on the case, because they really do not have much space into being, you know, credited for their hard work. So how it was working?
Of course. Well, the first thing is that selecting the team for me was, funny enough that you mentioned that, it's people who were not seeking credit. They were doing it for the right reasons. And that was the good point.
Because in like this kind of famous universal jurisdiction cases, there is a lot of kind of fame.
Press, everyone wanted to be there. Everyone likes to be there. Everyone likes to parachute and say, I've done this, I've built this, and all of that. So the key point is that the team I built around this case, both Jack and Svitlina, none of them, for a minute, asked for the limelight. They got it in the end, but without asking for it. And that's absolutely key so that we prioritize the cause and the victim, first and foremost. The second point is that this legal case involved three elements. It involved the strategic direction and the coordination and the media and figuring out what to focus, which was my role. It had the legal frameworks, the research, the wider principles that we need for that complaint, which was my colleague Svitlina's role, given that she's also an academic and a scholar at the University of Oxford, so she has that experience. But then it required legal, lawyerly rigors, like, you know, the statements, the paragraphs, the bullet points, the references. And that was my colleague Jack's role, and that's as a British barrister. So the three of us were able to come together and build this complaint that has strategic elements in it, has strong legal rigor, but is placed in a framework of international legal framework that we need. And so, you know, Jack, as you know, interviewed the victim, got the statement, worked with them on that. Svitlina did that kind of research. I put it all together, but it was absolutely a team effort between the three of us. But none of us could have done that if we didn't have the support from you, from the leadership, in getting access to the victim, in being able to kind of get the coverage that we need, in having the funding. So while the legal team did the majority of the heavy lifting, we still operated in a system, the TRP system, with your help, to make sure that we are able to deliver in that sense. Because if we did not have that, we would not have been able to deliver.
You know, you're working for quite some time on, let's say, various human rights cases. We traveled to Argentina. We were there. What was your, you know, take away?
This was the first case that I do in Argentina, where the victim is obviously also with us in that sense. It was a very eye-opening experience, I would say, how things shifted every minute. Right, there's too many variables to control when you are there. There's the media, the victim element, the court element. You remember there was the flooding.
Yeah, I would explain it. Yes, we were supposed to come to the court, but there was rain and court flooded. That's why we couldn't really properly film in the court. Exactly. And such things happen.
Exactly. Managing the timings and all of that. So what I learned first and foremost is that how at any moment this could have collapsed. Anything that went wrong in that sense. And so being able to adapt, being able to kind of keep everyone together as a team was, you know, a very important part of that. I also learned a lot about the victim and the survivor and his perspective about why he's doing this and why he's going, you know, because for us, for you as a journalist or for me as a lawyer, you know, we are able to write about, we're able to do the legal work, but in the end, it's about what he suffered, right? And I learned a lot about his resilience, the lengths that literally he's willing to go through in order to be able to achieve something. And I learned a lot about Argentina. I learned a lot about their struggles. I learned about their judicial system. I learned a lot about their culture. I learned a lot about also how they fought and how they created a process to be able to push back. So, you know, I might know how to operate the law, but I learned a lot during this process.
A different question. You're of Syrian origin, and for your previous legal work, you were focused on Syria, and you said that, you know, as a lawyer, there are a lot of crimes committed globally, a lot of foreign wars, also in the Arab world, but you decided that, yes, you do not work with other wars and conflicts beyond Syria, but Ukraine. Explain.
So I still work on Syria. So it's not very much my previous work. As you know, I still split my time between Syria and Ukraine. The reason I focused on Syria is obviously I am from there, and I wanted, and Syria is a horrific situation, and I felt I can help the most there. Because in the end, I believe that I have privileges. I have education, language, a passport that allows me to travel. And the place I can help the most is my people in Syria. And that's why I focused on Syria for the last 10 years exclusively. Obviously, when other things came up, I would assist here and there, but I never made it my cause. When Ukraine started, I saw that as, I wouldn't even say an extension of the cause. I would say that as part of the cause. Because what Russia is trying to do in Ukraine, it did in Syria. Not just the crimes, that's one side. Because crimes are committed everywhere. But the idea that Russia wanted to quash the self-determination of the Ukrainian people to decide for you what you want, and to install puppets, and to make your ability to choose impossible. This is what you know, Ukraine's choice is about. And it did that in Ukraine illegally, but it did it in Syria, quote-unquote, legally, by supporting the official government quash the people's self-determination. So the core of this was self-determination in that sense. And so the struggle in Syria continues. But when Ukraine started and we saw that President Zelensky and others kept talking about Syria and Syria and Syria, we wanted to also help. And we wanted to send a message of solidarity to the Ukrainians that we know your pain and we're standing by you. And whatever experience, bad experience that we have, we want to kind of offer it. To also send a message to Russia that the people that you thought you crushed in Syria, you haven't. And we're back again on, as the prosecutor called it, the front lines of justice. And we are there fighting side by side with Ukraine. And initially that might have been kind of an answer that not a lot of people might relate to. But do you remember two things happened? We spoke together at the frontline club once, and a Ukrainian lady came up to me and she said, "Why are you passionate about Ukraine?" Right? And I don't think passion is something you can fake in that sense. So that kind of left a mark. But as you recall, with your help, I got a lot of Syrians to go into Ukraine. That's the first time we had a group crying exercise. You didn't see a lot of the tears, Natalia.
I haven't seen. I've seen all you being in Kyiv cheerful.
It's been recorded. Waad filmed parts of it. We felt a genuine sense of solidarity when we went to the Mariupol Regional Hospital. We were all feeling that we are here, they are tearing, we are tearing, but the sense of solidarity was real. It wasn't just a line that we would use. And then when the prosecutor tweeted with the first three words in his tweet after our meeting, "Like no other, the Syrian people understand our pain." This to me signals that this resilience is mutual. And that is why I personally continue to work on Ukraine.
So then I would return to that visit. So I will remind that it was the 10 years of anniversary of the chemical attacks, and there was a solidarity visit to Ukraine of a group of the most senior civil society leaders from Syria who came from the US, from London, from Turkey, from wherever they are, including the people like the head of the White Helmets and the others, to Ukraine for a couple of days, despite all the risk meeting people. But there was something very interesting you mentioned, that for the first time you felt, how is it to have stayed behind you?
Yes.
So I'm curious to say, you know, so what was for you there? I want you to elaborate about that, but I'm also now kind of not say, I really don't know how you can, you know, where do you find your strengths? Because we do have stayed behind us. And we still can be very disappointed and lose a bit of resilience.
Well, you're making me emotional again. I mean, all what we asked for in 2011 was a state. right? A state that kind of represents our interest, a state that we can select, not a state that's passed down by father to son to grandson. And yes, we had countries that would express support and, you know, host and so on, but not really felt the sense of solidarity as much as it was in Ukraine. Throughout this process, from the support when it came to the visas, from at the borders, when we got to past midnight, past the curfew, when we got to the bus station and we went down and there was a delay, and, you know, we caused a little bit part of the delay because on the stops, my Syrian friends went around the shops a little bit, so the bus was delayed. But when we got in, there was official protocol from the prosecutor office waiting at like 1 a.m. with buses, with police cars, with official uniform. And when we got to the hotel and they escorted us and we saw the police there, again, she said three words: welcome to Ukraine. And throughout the conversations, it was clear that they were saying that you are the Syrians we recognize, not the Syrian regime that's standing with Russia, that's voting with Russia, that's sending fighters to fight with Russia. And the fact that we had things organized for us, had the police protection around us, for us really signaled that we are also valuable to Ukraine, valuable to the cause of Ukrainians, valuable against the fight against Russia. And we never felt that before. We never felt that, you know, there's someone physically looking after us, hosting us as with this sense of solidarity. That made a lot of people emotional. A lot of people emotional. The fact that we managed, through a miracle, to see President Zelensky, through an absolute miracle, you know, in that sense. But none of the people we spoke to from the state officials were trying to make our life hard. Did you come with us when we met the Crimean representatives?
Yeah.
You also saw that, I think, Wad was also crying at the end when she gave her scarf, you know, in that sense, and said, inshallah, which is the Arabic word for, or the Islamic word for, we hope so, God willing. In the same way, Crimea will be free, Syria will be free. It's that feeling, Natalia.
Why do you think now it's complicated? But now, I mean, I've been to the event, to one journalistic festival, and there would be people saying, like, and the question would be often to me asked, do Ukrainians feel that, you know, like Gaza is taking too much attention? Or the people would say that, oh, Ukraine has more attention than Gaza. But I remember that's what we discussed with Wad, the filmmaker, saying that, like, I heard those things about this competition, saying, like, oh, why Ukrainians are more welcome than the Syrians. But I never heard that from Syrians. I've never heard the Syrians to doubt, you know, like, the necessity of the support to Ukraine. But here in London or in Berlin or elsewhere, by other actors, we constantly somehow pushed against each other about, like, whose cause is more important, who's got more hypocrisy from the West and less hypocrisy. Why it happens?
Well, I think it happens for multiple reasons. First, there are the people who don't want to act that are looking for an excuse. They don't want to act on Ukraine, so they say, what about Syria? They don't want to act about Gaza, so they say, what about Ukraine? They say, why don't you want to act? They want to act, you know, it's an excuse to make themselves feel comfortable that there are other causes, and because I cannot do anything about any other causes, I will not do anything about this one, or the one that I can make a difference. So let's put these people aside, because they're doing it for malicious reasons. They're not doing it for good reasons. The second type of people, it might be an allocation of resources. I have time, where should I put it in that sense? And I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, the attention is limited, the funding is limited. But we have always said that war crimes or impunity anywhere supports impunity everywhere. So if now is the attention on getting justice in the situation of Gaza or Ukraine, in that sense, it will make a big difference. So let's look what might happen in these 2 weeks. All of the support to the ICC on Ukraine is now, in my opinion, will be hugely affected by how the West reacts if arrest warrants come out against Israeli officials from the ICC. So the support for the ICC in Palestine, if an arrest warrant comes out, is absolutely crucial to the work of the ICC in Ukraine, so that it doesn't undermine it. It doesn't cut the funding of it. And so the causes are so interlinked, not by geography or perpetrators, or by norms. We are living at a time, Natalia, where if we just let things slip or we don't focus on one place, the entire system is going to break. We are living through that. That's why we've always resisted this idea of comparisons. you know, at the macro level. And obviously on the micro level, at the person, the mother, the sister, the daughter, the spouse, that obviously you can't even compare the pain or suffering. So Syrians never ever said, why are you focusing on Ukraine and you forgot Syria? I mean, even in the anniversary of the uprising in March, in Syria, Ukrainian flags were being flown. And we're very proud of that.
Can you tell a bit more, since, you know, the start of the war in Syria, and since where you are as a society, and where what is going on with injustice? You know, you have a lot of causes, but where they are, what was successful, what is not, and what is a challenge?
I guess the success has been that we have not given up, and we're continuing to fight 13 years on. It could have been very easy for the regime and Russia to just crush us and not, and for them to be remembered as the victors and as the ones that crushed terrorism or whatever it is, like what they tried to do in Ukraine. So the first success is that we haven't given up. And when the refugee wave started, people thought these people were just going to stay and not do anything. But you saw a lot of activists come out of the refugee and kind of get into their governments and try to do something. So that, in my opinion, that's the first success case. The second thing is, because justice was blocked, so many new mechanisms were created. So Syria was set the precedent on things. So for example, there's now, because we don't have an international court that can look into Syria, the General Assembly governments voted to create a mechanism to prepare cases if there's a court. So not just to document, but to build cases and just wait. So this mechanism called the IIIM was the first time it was created in that sense because of Syria. Then for the first time, we have a UN-backed mechanism for the missing, because there is no other mechanism. So in June last year, the General Assembly created something called International Organization for the Missing in Syria. So we are creating new things. We had some universal jurisdiction cases. Now we have an ICE International Court of Justice case. Netherlands and Canada took Syria to court over torture. We have like this ecosystem. We don't have one court. We don't have one place. We don't have any of that. But perpetrators have not won, because we define the battle and we are fighting it in that sense. Sometimes things move back and forth, but this is where we are now. Lots of crimes, lots of activism, lots of victim associations that are pushing forward. The country is split into different areas of control. The fighting has calmed down relatively, not because anyone cares, but just because Turkey is now in, the US is in, Russia is in. So now if Russia moves in Syria, it kills a Turk. It doesn't kill a Syrian anymore. They can kill an American. So now the political stakes are higher in the different places. Previously, it was just proxy. Now there is a physical Turkish army, physical American army, physical Russian army on the ground, you know? So now they're more careful when they bomb in that sense. So the military front has calmed down, but the justice front hasn't. And we are still fighting every single day.
How did you get into that? You were studying in Oxford, the law, having pretty okay
so
life.
I come from a business family. My family is in coffee, in the coffee industry. We have, from my uncles, my granddad, my dad, we're all in the kind of coffee and construction industry. So I come from a privileged family that grew up in different parts of the world. I was studying in Manchester law, and I was supposed to do commercial law in 2011. That's what I wanted to do. I applied. If you look at my statement to apply to university, all it has to do is with commercial law and all of that. But then the year I started university is the year the conflict started. And so I switched everything that I do to criminal law, to human rights. And I set up an NGO that now is funded by 5-6 governments to do legal work. And I used to travel to Syria, then go back to my lectures, then travel to Syria, then go back to my lectures for 3-4 years. So this is how it started. I never say that I have a career. The career was the byproduct. The financial means to sustain a family was a byproduct. It was always a focus on trying to help, my Oxford education was because I quickly saw that my legal education is not enough for justice policy. I need a master's in public policy. And that's why I went to Oxford and did a master's in public policy with 2 children. That's the idea of it. And so how I got into that is by fate, not by choice. I don't regret anything. In that sense, other than my ability to hopefully be able to help more.
If we speak about the crimes committed in Ukraine, what do you observe? What is your general takeaway after a couple of years working with us?
For me, it's the diversity of the crimes, right? You have attacks on infrastructure, you have torture, you have forced deportation, you know, you have sieges in certain places, you have this attack on nuclear facilities, on dams. So that there's a big diversity around it. The second thing that I kind of see, in a way, is the propaganda that comes with it to try and hide those crimes. Not unprecedented, you often have it, but the Russian machinery is in full power, you know, trying to deal with that. I think also the willingness of the Ukrainian victims to fight back, you know, to give their evidence, to push and so on.
Isn't that common? Because that's for us, like, kind of, we think that's
from
how it is.
Different places that I've worked or seen, not always. People get tired. People don't necessarily have the means to fight back. Of course, in every conflict, you have heroes and leaders and people who are pushed, but there are a lot of people who get tired and don't want to have that fight. No, so I wouldn't say it's often common in that sense. That's also a kind of a very interesting part of it. As you said, the fact that you have the state working on the justice, you have some international courts working on justice, that's kind of quite important also in that sense. But I also see that, for example, when it comes to the issue of children, right, the deportation of children, Russia wasn't really hiding. And that worries me, because they think they can get away with it. And it's good that the ICC issued the arrest warrant, and that created implications for their BRICS membership or their ability to attend, you know, BRICS meetings and so on. But that really shows how Russia was emboldened by other conflicts like Syria, like Chechnya, like Georgia and so on, to think that they can get away with it in that sense. I think that's quite a phenomenon.
But if you speak about the toolkit as well, what do you mention? Toolkit of the way how Russia is fighting, you know, like when you look at Mariupol and Aleppo, when you look at the double strike.
Yeah.
So what are the things which you think that they're not that unique to Ukraine? Some things you see like, okay, I've seen that.
The policy you see, like, for example, the bombing of hospitals, the intimidation of witnesses, supporting torture, all of that is stuff, is that playbook you see in different conflicts. And you see that Russia has done that, you know, the double taps when they attack a place, they wait until the responders come and then they hit it again. These are things that you see. But obviously every crime scene is unique. Every pain is unique. And that policy exists. And so when Russia tries to say that these were isolated incidents, or these, you know, are not representative of policy, that's not true. They've done that in other places, and it's well documented. And that's what hopefully we will show also with the TRP report that should be upcoming soon on this issue.
I have also quite a couple of legal questions, and that's what we discuss. What I understand, they are pretty public, and you can speak about that. First, on the deportation of rather fast number of documents, on the deportation of the children. So how we fight the argument that Russia tries to protect them and evacuate them from the dangerous place?
The starting point is that usually perpetrators don't tell you they are perpetrators, right? They always try and find the excuse. So what Russia is doing is, you know, in one way, what they would do if they were standing trial. When it comes to the issue of children, international law has been very clear in former conflicts that you cannot use your own actions to justify the lack of security for others. You cannot say that because the military situation is dangerous when you caused that military situation. You cannot use it as an excuse. That's point number one. Point number two, things need to be temporary. Places, frameworks need to be put in place. All of things that are missing, and that's as the proof to the intent that they wanted to forcibly deport those people. People need to have a genuine choice whether they stay or they leave. And it's very clear to us that they do not have that genuine choice to stay. That doesn't mean that Russia will not argue on the opposite. That's why lawyers exist. That's why judges exist, because both sides argue and it's for the judge to choose the argument. But it's clear to us that the reasons these security implications exist is because of Russian actions, and then therefore it cannot be justified.
For different type of crime, and I remember we discussed that in the Frontline Club, the attacks are missile strikes. We now have another ICC two warrants on the attacks on the civilian infrastructure. However, I understood that generally there is a internationally reluctance to investigate the crimes connected to the missile strikes. How to find that argument?
It's a harder one, because there are kind of exceptions and precautions that you can take in order to justify a strike like that. So giving warnings, assisting the evacuation of civilians, doing all that you can to avoid civilians. But the reality is, Natalia, like, death and war and civilian casualties is not outlawed by war. It's not outlawed by the law. because if you outlaw any civilian death, people will not listen to you. It's not that they will not stop, they will stop war. They will still have war, but they will not abide by any rules. So when the rules were created, they were created in a way that allows parties to fight, but try to minimize, not end, minimize civilian casualties. And therefore, when you are you're attacking, it's almost worse to not know how many civilians you're killing. It's better to know that you're killing 5 civilians, but there's a military objective that, in your opinion, justifies the death of those 5 civilians. And so that's why people are reluctant to choose these crimes, because unless they are intended to be on a civilian object that is indispensable, that does not offer a military advantage, where the collateral damage is not excessive in that sense, where the argument of proportionality does not hold, they can have an argument as to why they did that strike. It's a little bit harder. But then they have to show what steps they have taken to minimize the civilian casualties in that sense. That is the reason, because war unfortunately produces civilian casualties.
Ukrainians are also keen, you know, and it's media-wise, of course, people would speak about, you know, can we speak about genocide? Can we speak about crimes and humanity? But sometimes the lawyers say, look, it's sometimes even difficult to prove that this is a war crime, not just like a misconduct. In this context, again, like working a couple of years on Ukraine and seeing hundreds of testimonies we've collected, how would you describe what the crime is committed in Ukraine?
I think we need to distinguish what the law offers and its limitations, and you know, whether or not the law can develop. So the starting point is that the laws, these are all man-made laws. They're supposed to develop and they're supposed to address the specific situation. Obviously, as you highlighted, the threshold of genocide is quite high. And it was set high in order to kind of hopefully prevent it and to be able to make a case against it. I know the argument exists. I haven't seen all the evidence to make a judgment. I think in certain cases, there are certain statements. There are hallmarks of you know, attempts to commit genocide, not across all sorts of crimes. But I'm always reluctant to answer this question as a lawyer. It's part of the answer. It's not all of the answer. When you think of it as a lawyer, they're like, okay, what sort of punishment would you get? What is the victim getting from charging something as genocide versus a war crime in terms of a punishment? It's the same punishment at the end. One is harder to prove. And this goes to the very, very first questions you asked me towards the beginning about perpetrators and victims and processes. So it's very clear for the Ukrainians, very clear to me that the Ukrainians, a lot of them, want to have a charge of genocide, even if it doesn't hold perpetrators to account or cannot arrest or is harder to prove, because the narrative and the process matters in that sense. So definitely something to kind of keep being assessed in that sense, but not just to be constrained to the law as it exists now.
Missed one thing which I want you to speak, the thing you're working a lot about, use of the chemical weapon. What is really like this major, you know, case, which is you devoted so many years of your life?
Sure, so...
And where we are
so with as you know, the chemical weapons unfortunately were used in Syria by the regime mainly, and some terrorist organizations, but mainly by the government. And this is something that almost 100 years ago, governments have said we're not going to use chemical weapons, to the extent that they were not properly used in World War II. Like, we managed to avoid them being used in World War II. They were used in Syria. The evidence is there. The documentation is there. The perpetrators are known, and there is no accountability. So what we're trying to do is to build an exceptional court, an exceptional tribunal from different governments coming together to say, the world is blocked, but we will find a way to deal with chemical weapons in that sense. But again, linking to your first point, I'm trying to kind of bring global north and global south around it, because that's, in my opinion, the last norm that we can bring both around it. So we have victims and survivors of chemical weapons, legal experts and others. We've spoken to so many different governments, and we're hoping at least to keep the process alive of accountability for chemical weapons in that sense.
I'll finalize with something you mentioned couple of times, keeping the process alive. Again, like, you are the lawyer, but I often hear so much from the people, why to do that? Why to pursue? Why to do that? Why to do this individual cases if they take so many years?
Look, Natalia, we have two options. We either make it easy for perpetrators to get away with it, or we make it hard. The choice is ours. I can tell you what we will do, what will happen if we don't do anything. But if there's a chance that something will happen because of the action, then it's worth it. I'm also a believer, and I know that I will not be asked or held responsible for the outcome. I'll be judged by what I have done, what you have done. That's the question. No one asks you to save Ukraine. No one asks you to hold Russia to accountable. The question is, with so many variables, not the outcome, but what you and your strength and your privileges and your time decided to devote the time to. So there's a part of that. But I just also see it as a form of justice to keep fighting. It's a form of accountability. When the perpetrators try to silence you, when the perpetrators try to arrest you, when they make your life difficult, even just fighting on you know, for justice is a form of accountability to them in that sense. Now, obviously, it's not for me to say that everyone should do that. People have their personal life, they have their own priorities, they have a lot of things that they care about. But I think we should not let them get away with it in an easy way. If I cannot push in one direction, at least I prevent them in pushing in the other direction and make it hard for them in that sense. I think in the end, it's also good for your conscience to be able to say, look, I'm doing what I can. I'm trying to help. And for the future generations to know that people resisted. We don't often hear about heroes, funny enough, in the past that led to a specific outcome. We might remember the outcome, but we remember the struggle. Remember the pushing. We remember the protests. We remember the signs. These are not outcomes. We don't remember them in the peace conference. We remember what happened to lead to the peace conference. And that really shows the human element in that. And then finally, it's to be able to keep going. If I just look at the outcome, I'll just be depressed if that's what I'm aiming for. But if I look at the process, I can keep that kind of fire in all of us to kind of keep pushing for it.
You know, our survivor, when he came to Argentina and he had a chance to meet the other survivors and talk to them. And you know, for him, being in Argentina, it was something he told. Like, we didn't lead him to that, was that for him, the most important was to see that these people who lived through something 30 years ago didn't give up. That was his major takeaway from his trip. Not the fact he submitted. Yeah. Really, not the fact that he technically submitted this. It was important. But he left with the idea that there are people in different places who are fighting for 30 years and they don't stop.
What sort of world would happen if we all stop? I think that's part of it. But again, I also think it's a privilege and a responsibility to be able to fight. Because not everyone can. Not everyone should. And so it's not just for us that we're doing it. We're also doing it on behalf of those who want to, but cannot. And we should never judge them in that sense. People have so many different priorities in life. But I think that is kind of our role. If I can leave a legacy for my children to move forward, that their dad was traveling all over the world, not being around, you know, to play with the Lego and do that, to be able to do a greater good, then, you know, on my deathbed, I'll be happy in that sense. Thank you, Natalia.
Thank you.